going to be a short introduction to the theory of research in turn series. We're going to see how it's organized, the main points, and finally we're going to get some special result that relates non-perturbative information with perturbative information. And that's going to be a main result for that part. And we're going to use it later, applying it to the topological string theory in the B model. And the main equation that we're going to use to extract non-perturbative data is going to be something related to the holomorphic anomaly equations that are used there. And we've finished with some conclusions and outlook. Okay, so the main idea of research in turn series is, again, this idea that you can organize non-perturbative information about the problem and then find some consistency relations that tell you how the perturbative, usually asymptotic growth, is related to non-perturbative information. And actually, that perturbative part knows essentially all about the non-perturbative corrections to that part. So let's start with something basic. In general, we're going to have a problem to solve. It can be a differential equation or a difference equation or some integral that depends on a parameter x. And we can try to find a perturbative solution, just the naive way to attacking the problem. What we may find in many cases is that the series has a zero radius of convergence because we have an factorial growth, g factorial, controlled by some instanton action, a to the minus g. So a very basic example would be Euler's equation, in which we try to solve this equation in a naive way through a power series. And we find that the coefficients are actually factorial. So they have a factorial growth indeed. Not only can we do a perturbative approach, sometimes there's a whole family of formal solutions that actually tell you the first example of a trans series. So instead of plugging a power series just as a series in X, we try to, or 1 over X, we try to plug a series that is not only in X, but only in e to the minus X, which is a non-analytic, thank you, which is a non-analytic function around X equals to infinity. So we're going to have a parameter sigma that basically tells you which member of the family you're working with. And we're going to have essentially the contributions around any instanton sector labeled by n. So if you try that for the example above, the solution is quite easy and the trans series truncates really quickly. So we get the usual perturbative part and then a correction that is a one instanton sector with no asymptotic about it, no series about it. But in general cases, we're going to have a full asymptotic with infinite number of instanton sectors. And sometimes we're going to have one, two, or three instanton actions, and sometimes even more complicated things. But for the purpose of knowing what the resurgents tell us, let us stick for the with this more simple example. So the problem is that we have an asymptotic series in general. So at some point we want to have an analytic function that is asymptotic to the initial perturbative series, if you like. So the classical answer would be to Borel resum that series. And the usual thing is just to remove the factorial growth that we know is there. The hope is that this series now has a non-zero radius of convergence and can be resummed completely in some parts of the complex plane. It can be maybe analytically continue along some direction of the Borel plane psi. And then taking a Laplace transform along some direction, you can obtain an analytic expression for your initial problem. Of course, this function is not going to be defined in all the complex plane, but it's some half plane. And we also have, very importantly, to assume that in the direction of integration theta, we're not going to find any poles of the Borel transform. Otherwise, the integration would be well defined. So for our example, the Borel transform is quite quick because we can remove the factorial growth. The sum can be performed exactly if chi is less than 1 in absolute value, and we have a function that can be analytically continued except at the pole at minus 1. So the integration part can be done in any direction except at the one in which you encounter the pole, and that is direction theta equals pi. So what happens when you actually want to do the resummation in that direction? Then you have to define some lateral resummations. You have to define some contours that go through the towards the pole and then have to dodge the pole either on the right or on the left. Okay. So why is this actually important? Why do we want to take these lateral resummations? Well, the thing is that the difference between the functions that you obtain both ways actually have non-perturbative information about the original problem you're trying to work with, you're trying to solve. So take the example of the Euler's equation. The difference between the two lateral resummations along the direction where the pole is have integral forms. The contour can be deformed into this expression here. So at the end of the day, what you're doing, computing this difference, is taking the residue of an exponential times the Borel transform. And that picks up this final result. And if you remember, the e to the x, to the x was actually the second part of the transserial solution to the Euler's problem. Okay, so this happens in general, and we're always going to find that the difference between these two resummations actually gives you essentially all non-perturbative corrections in an organized way. Okay. So imagine that we have a general problem, and we try to do the same kind of exercise in a given direction theta. But now we may have several poles. The Borel transform may have logarithmic branch cuts, maybe in that direction. So this kind of exercise, where we try to deform the contour, is going to be given by this kind of complicated contours. This is the analog of this. We can deform the contour back, just moving this part in the middle towards the left, so that we have this kind of image. And up to a contribution at infinity that in some cases can be shown to be zero, we can deform this path into some contribution at zero. Okay, and why is this important? It is important because if we take this kind of contour around zero of the Borel transform with a given power, it's going to select the perturbative coefficient of the perturbative sector. Okay. And this is important because we want to have a relation between perturbative sectors and non-perturbative sectors. And we just have learned that this kind of contour that came from the original one is actually telling us about non-perturbative information. So this is already the first clue that perturbative and non-perturbative information is encoded in this kind of relation. The problem now comes when you don't really know the Borel transform of your given problem, because either the series is too complicated or it's just impossible to resum in a closed form. So then what you know is that what really matters is the poles and the branch cuts of the Borel transform. And you just want to have some kind of object that captures that information. And this is where the theory of resurgence enters and defines the so-called alien derivative at a given pole that, when acting on the perturbative series, is going to actually capture what is the pole, the residue, and the function accompanying the logarithmic branch cut of the Borel transform around that point, around that pole. So there's an object that can be defined, is actually a derivative, and it captures the information that you want to relate perturbative and non-perturbative information. So this is the main starting point of resurgence. If you really go into it and try to put things on firm grounds, you can find that the difference between the lateral resummations, that is the thing that we started with, is actually related to this alien derivative through this so-called Stokes automorphism. So there's a series of equations that actually relate one part of the problem with another. And now comes the important part. In general, it's really difficult to calculate the alien derivatives because it's, again, the same problem of not being able to Borel resum something, of calculating the Borel transform or something. So it turns out that if your original problem satisfied the differential equation, there's a simple procedure to show that the alien derivative of your object you're trying to calculate at a given pole in the Borel plane is actually related up to a function to the derivative with respect to the parameter sigma that we saw in the turn series of the problem itself. So this is really nice because we have already actually dodged the bullet of trying to calculate alien derivatives. And we have transformed that into a problem of calculating only the turn series and taking a derivative with respect to this sigma. So you can take that bridge equation. You can plug in the turn series answers, compare similar terms. And for instance, the first thing that you're going to know is that the function that connects both parts, the alien and the derivative with respect to sigma, is actually a constant times a power of sigma. And this is this constant called Stokes constant is actually really important. It has information about the actual equation that F would solve. The problem is that in general, you don't really know sometimes what is the equation that you're trying to what is the equation that the function you're trying to calculate solves. And this is what's going to happen in our case. But in any case, if such an equation exists, then you can get the bridge equation and you're going to get the Stokes constant. So this Stokes constant is going to appear later on in our problem. Okay. So we have seen that the perturbative sector can be computed from alien derivatives related to non-perturbative sectors, but we can avoid trying to calculate any alien derivative and going through the bridge equation to all the other instanton actions, instanton sectors, sorry. So if you actually sit down and write things explicitly, for the simplest case, you're going to find that the perturbative coefficients are given in terms of the non-perturbative coefficients for any instanton sector and coefficient. So you're going to have instanton sectors lying around. You're going to have a factorial growth. And of course, you're always going to have the Stokes constant that has information about the actual equation that the system satisfies. So this is actually an expression that organizes very neatly all the non-perturbative corrections. Because the first term, the leading term of this expression, is the usual one. It's the one that tells you that the perturbative coefficient grows factorially and is controlled by an instanton action. But it tells you that the coefficient in front is the first instanton element. Okay. The second instanton element is going to be suppressed by a term of 1 over g. The second one is going to be 1 over g squared and so on. And once you have all of those, you can go to the second instanton sector. And that one is going to appear suppressed by a term of 2 to the g. And then you're going to have all the corrections coming from the second instanton sector. And then you can go to the third and so on. So you have all the information there. And it actually turns out that you can extract it if you're clever enough. And we're going to see a calculation, an example of that. Okay. So the main lesson from this is that this can be used actually to check consistently within your theory. If you can somehow calculate every term, you can then put it in, do some numerical calculations and check that you're getting the right answers. And this is what we're going to use in the end. Okay. So let us now talk about topological string theory and the holomorphic anomaly equations, because this is the setup in which we're going to try to apply this resurgence theory. So very briefly, just to review, topological string theory is based on a superconformal N equals 2,2 sigma model that takes maps from Riemann surface of genus G into a Calabi-Yau threefold, which we're going to assume is local. And it takes a twist on the algebra, and we couple them to 2D gravity. The twist is what gives you the Grassmann scalar symmetry that localizes the theory. And since the twist comes in two flavors, we have the A and B model. They're related, of course, by mirror symmetry. The A model localizes to holomorphic maps. At the end of the day, the free energies that you calculate for this model are going to depend on the Kähler structure of the Calabi-Yau. And with that, you can compute Gromov with the invariants using various techniques like localization or the topological vertex or things like that for toric Calabi-Yau, for instance. On the B model, localization gets you constant maps. The theory at the end of the day is going to depend only on the complex structure of the mirror. And the free energies can be very efficiently computed with the so-called holomorphic anomaly equations. And this is what we're going to work with. At the end of the day, what you're going to get in the perturbative part, or what you get usually, is just free energies for each genus G, and you organize the sum into an asymptotic series in the end. Because it turns out that for any point in modular space, these objects are usually diverge factorially. So that's why we're in the setting of resurgence. So the whole purpose of the rest of the talk is going to be trying to extend these to a trans-series ansatz with non-perturbative information and checking that the answers that we get are correct through these large order relations that we saw before. Okay. So I would like to mention the relations to topological strings to all the theories. Of course, it's related to physical string theory through compactifications on Calabi-Yaus, and the free energies then are going to give you couplings of that theory. It's related through large end duality to Chern-Simons theories on some three manifolds. It also knows about non-critical strings and minimal models when you select special values of the moduli. Then the free energies can undergo a double scaling limit. They basically go through a phase transition, and then you can arrive at minimal models. But also very importantly, topological string theory is related to matrix models. Usually when the potential is not a polynomial in the matrix. But when it actually is, the theory is actually strong enough to give you an equation for the free energy. And such an equation is dependent on the particular model you're working. But with that equation, you can actually try to plug in a trans-series ansatz, and you can compute a lot of non-perturbative information. And you can use these large order resurgent relations to check that everything you have is correct, that you have as many instantons as you need, that you have all the perturbative and non-perturbative sectors that you need. So this has been done for cubic and quartic matrix models. It has also been done when for other theories like Panleve 1 and Panleve 2, these equations that are related to these kind of matrix models and to 2D gravity. And there it has been shown that that you can have a whole trans-series, that the instanton actions that you get are not the usual ones. And usually you would assume that the exponential corrections to the perturbative part have to be exponentially suppressed. So you have to have something like e to the minus a x, where a has to be positive, otherwise the thing would blow up. But what people found first in the case of Panleve 1 is that you do not only have an instanton action that is positive, you also have the negative of that instanton action. And that has to be there, otherwise the resurgent relation won't work. So there's still the task of interpreting that kind of instantons in a physical setting. Okay, so the idea is that can we do actually this kind of computations for the topological string directly in the topological string without having to go to another dual theory, like a matrix model that knows about the topological string or something like that? And the answer is that we actually can. And the route is through the holomorphic anomaly equations. So the holomorphic anomaly equations for the B model tell you how the free energies fail to be holomorphic on the complex moduli. So this happens because when you couple the theory to 2D gravity, the usual argument that allows you to prove that that things are not going to depend on the anti-holomorphic part of the theory actually is obstructed because of this, because of the gravity insertions free energy. The good thing is that even though the free energies are not holomorphic, the failure to be holomorphic is controlled in a really nice way, the derivative with respect to the anti-holomorphic coordinate is actually given in terms of lower genus free energies in a recursive manner. So of course the relation is going to depend on some geometrical objects, the first of which is the covariant derivative on the coupling structure space. And then we're going to have other special geometry objects that actually make the equation, just as it is, difficult to integrate. This is because there's no closed expression of C bar in terms of T bar, so it makes the integration complicated. But we're going to deal with that later. People dealt with that later. One last thing about these homomorphic anomaly equations is that they're defined for G greater or equal than 2. There's another holomorphic anomaly equation for F1, but we actually want to take F1 and F0 as geometrical initial data. F0 is the prepotential. It can be extracted purely from periods of the geometry. And we want to think of those these two components as geometrical data that allow you to calculate perturbative parts and then non-perturbative parts, as we will see. So people introduce in the very first VCOV paper of Bershavsky, Chakotay, Guri, Vafa, where they introduced the holomorphic anomaly equations, they already introduced so-called propagators. But it was later that people realized that this could be really useful to have a really compact expression for the integrated free energies. So what one does is trying to remove the object that appears in front of the right-hand side of the holomorphic anomaly equations by defining an object such that this derivative and the holomorphic derivative equals the object. So the nice thing about this propagator, that is something that has a holomorphic and anti-holomorphic part, is that when you apply the covariant derivative on it, it's going to give you again propagators up to the Yukawa coupling, that is a holomorphic object that can be calculated from the genus zero free energy, and a perturbative ambiguity that appears because the propagator is only defined up to a holomorphic function. So at some point you have to make a choice of what kind of propagators you want to work with. But for every example, you can always fix these ambiguities and just keep working. So once you have defined that, you can rewrite the holomorphic anomaly equations in essentially the same way, but we have got rid of the special geometry object. And because of this closure of the propagators, we can actually integrate quite easily. The other nice point is that the genus one free energy that appears in the equations themselves can actually be shown to be proportional to the propagator once you apply a covariant derivative. And this is again another holomorphic ambiguity that you can fix at every point, at every example that you like. So now we have all the ingredients for the perturbative sector. Okay, and people can start integrating. But we want to go a little bit further from this. We want to have an equation that knows not only about perturbative sectors, but about non-perturbative sectors. So for that, we need to find some sort of master equation, a single equation to which we can apply, we can plug in a transitive answer. And it should be such that when we restrict the answers to be only the perturbative part, it should give us the holomorphic anomaly equations back. So people have already suggested forms on this. And what we do is just present the equations that they tried in a way that allows, that can take a transitive answer. So it has to be an equation for the free energy, it should be the full non-perturbative free energy. And it has the usual derivative with respect to the propagator, it has the second derivative term and the quadratic term. But then it has extra terms that are there just to ensure that when we plug in a perturbative answer, it's going to give us back the holomorphic anomaly equations. And these objects just depend on the initial geometrical data, F0 and F1. So once you have that and you have, when you plug in your answer, you calculate the perturbative sector, you have already used these three functions, and then you can go on to calculate more things, the non-perturbative corrections. Okay. So in general, this master equation should know about any topological string theory in the B model. So it should really allow for a lot of solutions, for a lot of transserious answers. In general, transserious can have several parameters, several instanton actions. Sometimes they can even have logarithmic sectors, which is they have some powers of the logarithm of the of GS, of the string coupling. But for these purposes, we're just gonna, for this talk, we can just restrict to the simplest case, in which we have a one-parameter transseries is controlled by an instanton action, and it has, for n equals zero, it has the perturbative part, which we already organize in a topological fashion. But then we have the non-perturbative corrections, and there we have a power series in GS that may start in a power different from zero. So we allow this small number to be possibly different from zero. Yes. No, it has to be GS. So this has to do with the fact that if we're talking about closed strings, we know that the non-perturbative correction should know about open strings. So the actual coupling should be GS and not GS squared. If we try to do... In the part one, I actually had e to the minus n a x.
Yeah, but x.
So now x is g to gs to the minus one. Yeah. Okay. These are different change of notation. So because we know that the series is topological, half of the terms of the series are zero. So this is really a series in gs, but half of the terms are zero. The odd terms are zero. So we relabel this F, if you like, what we called AG there is F2G now, or the other way around. Yeah, now we're going to have a 2G factorial, and we're going to see it later. Okay. But again, the non-perturbative correction should be powers in GS because they should be controlled by open strings. And in general, the instanton action and the non-perturbative free energies are going to depend on the complex moduli ZI and the propagators, which have the anti-holomorphic dependence. Okay. So if you plug this into the equations, the sigma to zero terms, which are the perturbative part, are going to give you the homomorphic anomaly equations. And one can integrate this in a systematic way and obtain that the structure with respect to the propagators is going to be a polynomial of degree 3g minus 3, where the coefficients are going to be rational functions in the complex moduli. Okay, but the good thing about the propagators is that you can have a nice expression for the anti-holomorphic part. It's all packaged in the propagators. So we want to know what happens with the non-perturbative part. So the equation is a little bit scary, but it's essentially the same equation that we have for the perturbative part. It has a derivative with respect to the propagators. Now it is enlarged by an instanton action term. It has derivatives of first and second kind on free energies. And then it has a quadratic term, again, enlarged by instanton actions. Okay, but it's essentially the same. It's again, a recursive equation because the free energy that you're trying to calculate is going to depend on the perturbative sector, on previous instanton sectors up to the same G, and from previous free energies of the same sector. Okay. So the integration should be straightforward as well. But the first equation that one actually encounters is for n equals 1, first instanton sector, and g equals minus 1, because we have relabeled g. And for that term, the first term actually is the one where all the terms except for the first are 0. So the first equation that one encounters in this tower of equations is the one that is telling you that the instanton action that you started with is actually holomorphic. Which is a really good news because the instanton action usually has in these kind of settings a geometrical interpretation in terms of cycles of the geometry. So if the instanton action were to be anti-holomorphic, were to have an anti-holomorphic part, it would be really weird to interpret in general. So this is really good news. And actually shouldn't be a surprise because already combining the knowledge that the perturbative free energies are asymptotic and the fact that they satisfy the holomorphic anomaly equations is actually enough to show that they are holomorphic. And the argument is quite simple. You basically write down the asymptotic growth, which now is 2g factorial of the perturbative free energies, is going to be controlled by an instanton action that in principle may depend on the propagators. And then it's going to have corrections in general. Okay, this is the first term of the large order resurgence relation that we saw at the end of the first part of the talk. So if we take the ratio of two consecutive free energies, you basically can extract the dominant instanton action when we take the limit of g going to infinity. Okay, because then the tails just go away. So we can take this equation. Now the argument is quite simple. Let's take a propagator derivative on both sides and just prove that on the right side, taking the g, the limit g going to infinity is going to go to zero. So you have to use again the large order growth of the perturbative sector in this part. You have to go to second order to have a non-trivial answer. You get this expression. And for the first term, you just have to use the holomorphic anomaly equations and again use the large order growth for every ingredient that you have. So you have to be a little bit careful with the second part because it doesn't have, because the terms are not all large order. You have some small terms. So there you can use some inequalities on the growth of the perturbative sector. And at the end of the day, putting all the ingredients together, you find that the derivative is essentially bound by zero, and it's actually zero. Okay, so this is something that you could have proved before trying any transserious answers or whatever. Okay, so let's go back and very quickly just review what is the structure of the solutions here that we found in the propagator. So the first equation for the first object that we can calculate is quite simple. It basically integrates to an exponential in the propagators times the holomorphic ambiguity. Holomorphic ambiguity always appears because we're integrating with respect to anti-holomorphic variable, so we cannot actually determine the whole function. And this is a problem that we'll solve perturbatively for every genus, and it's a problem that we will have to solve for the non-perturbative sectors. So you can go for every G and see that the general solution for the first instanton sector is an exponential times a polynomial of degree 3G. And you can go on and see what the second instanton sector is, and you find a couple of exponentials with some coefficients in from and some polynomials of different degrees. And you can go on and you can calculate every instanton sector. You're going to have more and more exponentials multiplying polynomials. And at the end of the day, the general structure of the free energy is going to be a bunch of terms. Each of them is going to have an exponential with a coefficient, and it's going to be accompanied by a polynomial of a certain degree. A degree is captured by this lambda. These numbers A and lambda are actually structural numbers that come from the form of the equation itself. And they actually can be captured in a generating function of this, like this form, with three formal variables that you can expand. For each power of rho, it selects you what instanton action you're at, and if you combine combine terms, you can read from the powers what is the value of A and lambda for each instanton sector. So the structure of the solution is classified this way. Of course, in every solution, you're going to have the holomorphic anomaly, and this is going to sit in the polynomial accompanying the exponential with the highest coefficient. And that's something you have to fix. A few comments about this derivation. The value of the BN, the sometimes called starting genus, of the number theory of this sector is actually not fixed by the equations. It's a kind of a free parameter. So you have to rely to large order relations, some numerics, to actually see what that is. This is not really a surprise because the actual equations should know about all possible models that you can put, and different models, different examples are going to have different values of Bn. So the, since the equation is not a specific equation for a given example, it may not know about all the details of the solutions. Also, the instanton action can be thought of as another holomorphic ambiguity because it's something that the equation doesn't fix, just as the usual holomorphic ambiguities. And this is because, again, the equation is not an equation in GS. It's an equation in the complex moduli. So we cannot expect it to know everything. At some point, we just have to rely on large order researchers' relations to know all the details. And again, things can be generalized quite a lot, and the structure of the solution is going to be quite similar. The last word is about the coefficients of these polynomials that appear in the general structure. In the perturbative sector, there were just rational functions of the complex moduli, but now, since we have instanton actions, they usually come from the Picard-Fuchs equation as cycles, and they have some hypergeometric flavor. So in general, the coefficients are going to be mixtures of rational functions and hypergeometric functions. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the ambiguities that we have to fix, and we're going to put in the same sack the instanton actions and the usual holomorphic ambiguities that appear when integrating. So it was proposed in the context of ABAM, which is essentially a matrix model calculation that has a relation to topological string theory, that the instanton actions that control the large order for each point in modular space can actually be written in terms of combinations of cycles of the geometry. So if your geometry is essentially, at the end of the day, controlled by some Riemann surface, for instance, genus 1, as is the case, and this should be a torus, but you have A and B cycles, which are the usual ones, and then you have a C cycle, which is a constant that appears only because the geometry, the Calabi-Yau geometry is local. So this structure for the instanton action was actually proposed in general for any topological strings, and the fact that we found that the instanton action is holomorphic is good news because we can try to actually calculate the instanton actions by putting a proposal as a combination of cycles, and then we just have to fix the coefficients in front of each cycle. And that is done using large order relations from resurgence. So if we take a simple example, like the case of the mirror of local V2, which is determined by a Riemann surface of genus 1, it has a complex moduli that is one-dimensional, it is parameterized by Z, so we have no indices now, I or J. And this modular space has three special points, which are the large radius, conical, and orbifold. One can go on and calculate solutions to Picard-Fuchs equations, which are going to give you the cycles of the geometry. And these are going to be the building blocks for the instanton actions. So the other part that you need to know is you have to calculate as many perturbative free energies as you can, because these are the building blocks to calculate numerically non-perturbative information. So as we saw before, the free energies are factorially divergent, dominated by an instanton action. If we take a ratio, it's gonna give you the instanton action in this form. So if we have calculated enough free energies, we can take numerically the limit and get some information about the instanton actions and compare it against combinations of periods. So if you do this for this case, you find the following picture. We're going to try to calculate the dominant instanton action for several points in moduli space. So we're going to take the values of Z being real and negative, because there we have the conical point and the large radius point and the orbifold point. And we're going to change that axis to something else to make it a little bit more clear in the picture. For this case, the instanton actions that we find are purely imaginary, so we just plot the imaginary part. But we see that in different parts of moduli space, different instanton actions dominate. And that is what is captured by the ratio of free energies, the dominant part, the smallest one in absolute value. So we see that the prediction that is in blue or in red actually matches really well the numerical values calculated that appear in green. Okay. In general, one can be really precise if you have enough data, enough free energies from the perturbative pot. Okay, so last word about this. Of course, this relation, because the instanton action is holomorphic, should work whether we put the holomorphic value of the propagator or any value of the propagator. And one can actually check numerically that no matter what the value of the propagator is, it's going to give always the same result. Okay, so last part. The holomorphic ambiguities, now the ones that appear when we integrate, how do we fix them? In the perturbative sector, the way to fix them, at least for local Calabi-Yau, was to look at special points in moduli space for the holomorphic limit of the free energies. Because there, especially at the conical point, on the large radius point, there was some prescribed behavior that these free energies had to take. So comparing to that prescribed behavior, one was actually able to fix completely the free energies for any genus. Okay, so for the non-perturbative part, we can actually have a look at this special point, see what happens when we take our non-perturbative free energies that we have integrated. We take the holomorphic limit and have a look near a special point. So a special point can be, for instance, the conical point. Near the conical point, the perturbative free energies satisfy the so-called gap condition. They basically grow factorially through the Bernoulli numbers, and they have a pole at the conical point of order 2g minus 2. And then they have a gap, no other poles, and after that they have a regular part that depends on the actual example that you're working with. Okay, but the singular part is general. It works for every model. So the idea now is to use the large order relations that come from resurgence, and that for our case have this form. Now we have 2g factorial growth. We have the instanton actions on top, on the bottom, and the corrections from the non-perturbative sectors. So the idea is to have this relation, plug in these objects here, and try to extract information about instanton actions, free energies, maybe this piece as well. Okay. And what we're going to find is that after you have extracted that data, it turns out that this tail that depends on the model itself, it just goes away. And this is because of the pole that we have here and taking a G limit. So to be more explicit, from that relation, we can extract the instanton action, as we saw before, just as a ratio of free energies. If we know the instanton action, we can take another combination that will extract in the large G limit the B1. If we know B1, we can extract through another combination the first instanton sector. If we know that, we can do another combination to know the following component of the first instanton sector. And we know if you know the whole first instanton sector, you can go to the second, and so on. So the idea is to plug the gap condition here and try to take the limit. And because of the pole, it turns out that the tail in the gap condition goes away, and you find a sort of universal result for the holomorphic limit of the non-perturbative sectors for any model. The problem, of course, is that you can only calculate things up to the Stokes constant. So you're always going to have to carry the Stokes constant all the way. But this provides a method to fix ambiguity for these sectors related to the conical point, because you can get your integrated free energies from the holomorphic anomaly equations, take the holomorphic limit, compare against it, and solve for the holomorphic ambiguity. Okay. Of course, this is not universal strictly, because for each model you're going to have a different form of the flat coordinate around the conical point. But syntactically, at least, formally, it has the same form. And the question is, what happens to all the sectors that are not associated to the conifold instanton action? What happens to mixed sectors if you have several parameter transseries? Well, then you really have to take a complete resurgent relation and try to study numerically what happens. You have to really go deep into the perturbative sectors to know, to extract information about the non-perturbative ones and try to figure out how these ambiguities are fixed. So this is work in progress, and we try to get some results about it. So now I'm gonna show a couple of plots, maybe four, that tell you the agreement between between what you get from the integrated free energies when the holomorphic ambiguity is fixed through this method, and compare it against large order analysis, numerical analysis. So you just plot the real and imaginary parts of that combination. This is going to be, from the structure of the solution, it has to be an exponential in the propagators times the ambiguity. We have fixed ambiguity through this method. And we're plotting for a fixed point in moduli space against essentially the propagator. So it has to be, and since we're essentially taking the propagator to be purely imaginary, we expect that the exponential in the propagator is going to behave like a wave, and this is actually what we find. If you go to the following sector, you can calculate the free energy. It's going to be an exponential times a polynomial of degree 3. You can fix the ambiguity through this method, check it against large order for any value of the propagator, and you see that there is an agreement. And you can go on and see that now you have a polynomial of degree 6 times an exponential, 9 and 12, and there's a great agreement with that. To check the next instanton sector, you would have to be able to compute all the components of the first instanton sector, resum that, and then go there. And that's something that can be done numerically through Borel-Pader resummations, but that is work in progress as well. So let me just conclude and have an outlook of the problems to handle in the future. So we have seen that the framework of resurgence is strong enough to be applied to topological string theory once we have found a master equation to which we can plug a transserious answer. And there, from that, we can get non-perturbative information. We saw that the structure of the solution generalizes from a perturbative polynomial in the propagators from the perturbative part to exponentials times polynomials. We saw that the instanton actions are holomorphic, and we saw that from both from the equations and from an argument from large order. And we also saw that in some particular sectors, holomorphic ambiguities can be checked. You can check it against large order, and you see that that non-perturbative calculations is actually correct. Of course, for other sectors, further study is needed. So we're trying to work out the basic examples of local P2 and a more interesting example of local P1 cross P1. We have to take to do a thorough check of researchers' relation for these particular models to see exactly how many instanton actions we have, and that we can fix the holomorphic ambiguities for every sector. And the nice thing to do after that would be to compare against other non-perturbative proposals that have appeared recently for the topological string. So, thank you.
So, I have two questions. I may have missed, I'm sure I have missed, but the one thing was the polymorph anomaly equation was originally derived in the quantitative method, right?
Yes. Well, the idea that taking the tower of holomorphic anomaly equations, putting it into one equation and trusting that it's going to give you non-perturbative information, well, that's something that may not work. And that's why you have resurgence relation that allow you to check that, that the computations that you get for the non-perturbative part actually have something to do with the real problem. And since the perturbative part is asymptotic, it has some resurgence properties, you have this internal check that the equation that you propose as a master equation has to work. And the other question was?
There's a non-trivial consistency.
Yes. That's the power of the resurgence relations there.
And then there's also another question about this. So if there is an intrinsic.
From this point of view, there is not, because as you said, the holomorphic anomaly equations were derived perturbatively. They actually rely on
that. You said those non-perturbative terms could be related to different.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there have been proposals to extend the non-perturbative free energy using refined topological strings, the refined holomorphic anomaly equations sometimes. That basically it was done for ABJM by Hatsuda, Marinho, and other people, and they basically are able to compute the full free energy because in the ABJM you have a matrix model description. There you know the full non-perturbative information, and they were clever enough to find an expression in terms of the perturbative free energies that you get from the holomorphic anomaly equations, another information from the refined topological string, and certain combination actually gives you the same result as you get from the non-perturbative definition of ABJM as a matrix model. But the good thing is that they wrote it in a way that could actually be applied to for any topological string. So they actually suggest that the formula that they found could actually be a right proposal for the full non-perturbative free energy. So that's why it would be interesting to check these results, which are easy to get except for fixing the holomorphic ambiguity against these other proposals.
Another place where one computes non-perturbative G-string effects these days is this work of Boris Piolin and collaborators, where they look at corrections to hypermultiplet modular space and also higher derivative corrections. And there they certainly say, that evidence of not only a three brain instanton, but also say, five brain.
Yeah, actually, the good thing about this method is you can take the same equation and try to generalize your transitive answers as much as you want. The only constraint is that the resurgence relations have to give it the okay. And the resurgence relation can be quite tricky. If you don't have all the ingredients correctly, then numerics won't work. So this is actually an internal way to predict objects in your non-perturbative structure of the solution. So you may find something like that. But you have to start with simple examples, work out things properly, because the problem of fixing the ambiguity is not a trivial one. But yeah. I mean, this framework is quite powerful. Of course, it has caveats. You have to resum at the end of the day to have a full function. But in principle, you have, in a very organized way, all the non-perturbative information that the problem has. So it's just a matter of extracting it and giving it an interpretation. The one cut?
The multi-cut.
Yeah, that's a complicated problem. People are working on that. But in principle, for the multi-cut, you can have transceiver solutions. You have to get your string equations from the matrix model. There is a little bit more complicated. You have to solve for a couple of auxiliary equations through a transceiver ansatz. Then compute the free energy from those couple of auxiliary functions and check the large order resonances. And it seems to work for some cases. There's some flavor of it, but I'm not sure if people have actually resummed some transceivers to give a theta function. You have some explanations there, so maybe that you have something going on. But that's something for the future, yeah.
Okay. So, very good.
Just a very short question. Why is it not actually imaginary, or is it always true?
No. It was just, in general, it's going to be complex. You have to take that into account. Well, if you have the instanton action coming from related to a conifold point, there usually you're going to have near the conifold point for a real complex structure, you're probably going to have an imaginary action. But in general, I don't know of any criterion that is going to tell you when you're going to have that. In general, you can have anything, and for ABGM, for instance, you can have purely complex with any phase, and you can see that from large order as well, actually.